Okay, thoughts on Nicolas Cage?
I think he's a genius. I mean, he keeps getting hired for some reason, and it's not because of his hair.
I don't know. If I was in 70 films over 30 years and I spent each one talking at random volumes, I might accidentally win an Oscar.
I think our opinions about pop culture are fed to us by machines designed to criminalize human autonomy.
Good one. Dear God.
Okay.
Go, stand back. Give him space.
Nicolas Cage, good or bad? A challenge, certainly, but not insolvable. Because all actors have distinct values, which I use to find answers.
Abed, how much Nicolas Cage did you
get? Enough! I watched enough to find the answers. Because this is my reality. This is how I learned to be. And my being doesn't allow for Nicolas freaking Cage, okay? Oh, yeah. I'm a cat. I'm a sexy cat.
Abed, think of something safe, like Holly Hunter or Don Cheadle.
Johnny?
Yes, that's it.
That's not Johnny's fault.
The dumbfounded faces right at the end of that scene, I think, say more than I ever really could. But yeah, I just
put away and forget.
Oh, I lost my head.
If you knew how many times I've done that scene for my friends and family. With the equal amount of energy as Nicolas Cage did.
Oh, man, that's amazing. Love I'd that never scene. Seen this film before until this week, so I had yet to experience it. And, DK didn't want to be on this episode because he's busy with other stuff, but I did show him that clip as soon as I'd seen it because I was like, I was watching the movie and I was like, good film, steady movie, fair enough. And I was like, Nicolas Cage just turned up and this film got really weird and so different in like the first scene. So I just sent him that scene that I'd recorded on my phone and I'm going to reveal his very brief feedback in the audience feedback section because anyway, you a fan of Nick Cage's performance in this movie, everyone?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm a fan of every Nick Cage performance, though, so.
So you're definitely on the good side of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm with Shirley. He might accidentally win an Oscar if, you know, he just shout random volumes. Yeah. Anyway.
Did Christopher Walken?
Oh, man, I mean, yeah, you said it. Yeah, anyway, we'll jump into the episode probably. I have got a script, I promise. I just could not resist adding those particular linked videos. So, 3, 2, 1. Ah, Benvenuti. Welcome, dear viewers and listeners, to another episode of the Silver Screen Podcast Original. For this one, we've reassembled the Discord crew, our own dysfunctional extended family, and we're heading to 1980s New York to stare at the sky with Cher and Nicolas Cage as we all get moonstruck. I am Mike, your regular host, and I suppose the Olympia Dukakis of these proceedings, holding everything together with nobility, deep thoughts, and dry wit. Joining me are our two Cher stand-ins. Firstly, welcome, and may no curses fall upon her, to Adrienne. Welcome.
Somebody tell a joke. Hello, everyone. Yay. Nice. Happy to be here.
Yes, glad to have you back. And secondly, welcome back to Sandy Evanson, who'd surely come with any of us to the opera. Is that fair to say, Sandy?
I'm going to steal the Declaration of Independence.
Wrong movie.
Oh, darn it. Okay. Well, that's okay. I love this one too.
That's fair enough. And finally, our group wouldn't be complete without him. Sometimes as mad as Nicolas Cage and sometimes as charming as John Mahoney. It's Toby. Welcome.
Hi. Do you believe in life after love?
Oh, a Cher reference. I like
it. Awesome.
Oh man, she won an Oscar and all you can think of is her 90s disco hit, honestly. Yeah. We're all ready to share our thoughts on this movie anyway, but before we pour the champagne, I have to add the little sugar cube of flavour that is the behind the scenes section. So, are we all ready for this? So I'm just going to dive straight in. If you, hey guys, if you have any thoughts, just feel free to interrupt. As I always say, Moonstruck had a limited theatrical release on December the 18th, 1987, and was released nationally on January the 15th, 1988. The film earned critical and commercial success. It received 6 nominations at the 60th Academy Awards, winning 3 for Best Actress, Cher, Best Supporting Actress, Olympia Dukakis, and Best Original Screenplay, John Patrick Shanley. Originally, the film was called The Bride and the Wolf. As I alluded to just now, on both occasions that champagne is served, Loretta drops something into it. There is an old Italian superstition that the happiness associated with champagne attracts evil, so they drop in a sugar cube to distract the evil. It's also sometimes just because it's dry champagne and they want to sweeten it. The baby pictures seen at the end of the film are actual baby photos of Cher and came from her private collection. In June 2008, AFI revealed its top 10, the best 10 films in 10 classic American film genres, after polling over 1,500 people from the creative community. Moonstruck was acknowledged as the 8th best film in the romantic comedy genre. The film is also number 72 on Bravo's 100 Funniest Movies and number 41 on AFI's 100 Years, 100 Laughs. Influential film critic Roger Ebert entered the film to his Great Movies collection in June 2003. Now, Cher is 18 years older than Nicolas Cage and only 15 years younger than Olympia Dukakis, who plays her on-screen mother. Danny Aiello and Nick Cage play brothers, but Aiello is 31 years older than Cage. Yeah. Despite playing Italian-American characters, Olympia Dukakis is of Greek descent and Cher is of Armenian descent. Okay. I wonder if you get away with that nowadays. The customers leaving Camerari's bakery as Cher is entering, Mr. and Mrs. Fugacci are played by Charles and Catherine Scorsese, the parents of Martin Scorsese, which I did not know. Interesting. And when Johnny hails a cab at the airport after his return from Sicily, he asks the driver to take him to 19 Cranberry Street, Brooklyn. This is the real address of the house used for exterior shots. And I can't say if they got lots of people after the movie came out suddenly flocking there to take pictures and look for, you know, full moons. But I can imagine so. So, anything there that anybody thinks was shocking or that stood out at all?
No, not for me, because no. I did read through it, so I spoiled myself.
Oh, so you know the movie quite well. Yeah, I should probably have said up top, it was Adrian and Sandy who chose this movie in particular for us to do. We were looking for something to do with the whole Discord crew, because we'd like to assemble at least once a year or so just to review a film, the four of us. And this was the one they picked, so it's safe to say, Adrian and Sandy, that you are very familiar with this movie, yes?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And Toby, I'm guessing you, like me, have just seen it for the first time.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got two different angles that we're coming at this from, interestingly. So, yeah, the thing is, I normally would always start with kind of your first experience of the movie. With me and Toby, it's kind of pointless, because our first experience will be coming up in our reviews, because it's now. But I can ask you, ladies, what your first experience of the film was, what stood out, and can you remember the first time you saw it? Was it at the cinema? Was it on an old video? And... yeah, Adrienne, I'll come to you first and ask.
Well, this came out when I was living in Maine. And it was, I've always been a big follower of the Oscars. So there was a big buzz about it. I remember that. And I remember I went to Blockbuster and put my name on the wait list and got it on Blockbuster VHS.
Nice. Okay. What was your initial thoughts when you saw it, and what stood out the most?
Oh, I loved it. I just absolutely loved it. I just thought it was fresh and new and interesting, and I couldn't believe Cher and her acting, and I was thrilled to discover Olympia Dukakis. So I loved it.
Awesome. And what was it that made you decide that you wanted to cover this on the podcast? What specifically is that you love about it, I presume?
Oh, well, more than that, I love it, but you guys hadn't seen it.
Okay.
And I felt like we needed to share it. Everybody can experience this movie. It's so good.
Fair enough. It's something we all have to experience at least once. Okay. And over to you then, Sandy. What about you? Can you remember the first time you saw it and what your initial impressions were?
I do. I saw it on TV maybe about, 8 years after it came out. With a friend of mine who introduced me to the movie, but also it's when my late 20s is when I first started watching movies and TV shows in a different way. This is like the friend who started pointing out just kind of the art of movies and stuff. Before that, I had purely watched things for entertainment and didn't ever really appreciate movies in that way. And right. Of course, there are lots of movies that we saw, but this one in particular, it was the first time I had seen, and I just fell in love with it right away because I really did enjoy Nicolas Cage as an entertainer. And then just to see him in this film, and also a lot of the films we were watching, cinema has always had a love affair with New York, but particularly 80s movies in New York were just something different altogether, and just something very culturally significant about them. And so like all those movies, I really fell in love with, and this one in particular, the house, it just felt like a home. It's just I love the message of the movie and everything about it.
Okay. Not so sure about some of the messaging in the movie myself, but I'm sure I'll get to that one.
The final message.
Okay. All right.
I'll point out what I got from it. Yeah, we'll talk about
that. Fair enough. Yeah, no, I will. And I'm sure I'll point out my little gripes and grievances along with the things that I really did like when we get to talking about it. But so was there a reason why you wanted to specifically cover it on the podcast? Or like Adrienne, do you just like want to inflict it on everyone?
Exactly. And just hearing that Adrienne loved it as well, and we like so much of the same stuff.
Just wanted to talk,
and we haven't talked about it yet. So just being able to talk about it with somebody new, that's exciting to me.
Oh, cool. Awesome. And before I dive into the actual little sections that I break my notes down into, then Toby, is there anything you wanted to say about your first impressions that aren't too spoilery from the movie that you feel like sharing before we dive in?
Yes. My first impression was, I started the movie and my first thing was, oh, I need to turn on subtitles. I do not understand what the fuck Cher is saying. I don't understand. Give me the subtitles.
Fair enough. So you had a struggle to understand the kind of Italian-American accent, maybe, I guess. So,
and Cher's kind of quiet in the beginning of the movie. She's not screaming like Nicolas Cage is all the time.
So, yeah. Okay, cool. And this is a very different situation for you. Obviously, you're in Germany, so you didn't really grow up with, I guess, American culture quite the same way. Or did you? Did you have a lot of kind of American 80s culture coming your way when you were younger?
No. And I think that this is more an age thing than a location thing.
Yeah, that's really probably true. That's
because American culture nowadays is all over the place, and it was probably back then as well. Probably even more back then, I'd argue.
Okay, got you. Yeah, because of I can see that. Yeah,
Cold War and
American influence. Of course. Yeah,
actually 87 is towards the end. But
towards the end, obviously. Yeah, it's almost the fall of the Berlin Wall kind of thing. So, but no, it's weird because I'm surprised that I kind of missed this film in a lot of ways, because obviously I was born 82, so I grew up in the 80s. And there's lots of films that are similar to this in terms of feel and the kind of, New York rom-com type stuff that I know I have seen, even if they were, stuff that might be considered girly, because I also, again, grew up with a slightly older sister. So, I was going to say sometimes, most of the time, I had no choice in having to watch whatever she was watching. So, Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff like that I've seen, but this one wasn't one that I'd come across yet. And yeah, I do have a question about that later on. You know, do you guys think it's all very 1980s? I think it, you know, it's a product of its time in a lot of ways, but I'm sure we'll get to that because it's one of the questions, like I said, that I've got later on. So yeah, so starting to break down into the kind of notes that I analyze things with, I'll start with the writing and the plot. And I just have a little bit of information again to read out, BTS style. I'll start by saying the original screenplay featured a subplot that showed the characters played by Cher and Vincent Gardenia volunteering at a men's homeless shelter as penance for their sins, but that subplot was discarded, which is a shame. I think I could have potentially used that. Although the script was an original screenplay, many of the scenes that take place in the kitchen, dining rooms and restaurant have a distinctly live stage play feel to them. This was intentional by director Norman Jewison, who blocked and fully rehearsed the scenes way more intensely than film productions normally do. In the film, Uncle Raymond says he feels like Orlando Furioso. This is a reference to the 16th century epic poem by Ludovico Ariosto. It's about one of Charlemagne's knights who, in his adventures, goes on a rampage through Europe and Africa due to his unrequited love for Princess Angelica. Ariosto suggests that love is a form of madness, which is in keeping with the themes of this movie. Yeah, I had no idea. I had to look that up, if I'm honest. So yeah, before I kind of dive into my questions about the writing and the plot, is there anything that stands out specifically to you guys? And again, Adrian, I'll come to you first on that one.
I really liked the story, of course, but I guess I loved how all the characters all had their own little relationships together, and like, you know, how the writing was able to kind of let these characters grow, and we kind of know them at the end. Like, we understand the characters really well. So I thought that was good.
Okay, cool. And what about you, Sandy?
As far as the writing, I just like that it's a very original story, and that there's some subversion of expectation, especially when we find out that Ronnie has a very he's very cultural, that he likes art and likes opera, and just also that what the dialogue portrays is not what the people are really feeling. And that's a complicated thing to balance. People are not necessarily saying what they're feeling, but it still comes through. And I just thought that was a really interesting and unique aspect of the film, and how it ties to that cultural kind of the Italian diaspora of, you know, New York in that era. And I just love how they're bringing us into that.
Yeah. I'll come back to that in a second, actually, because I have a similar question that I could lead off of that about. But Toby, what about you? Was there anything that stood out in the writing for you? What was the main kind of takeaway that you got from the movie? What you thought it was trying to say, and what did you like and dislike about the writing and the overall plot?
I think it's really cool how this movie, well, we have the main couple, of course, but there's a lot of other couples and dynamics going around in this movie that are thematically tied together, which I think is really cool. Well, I do think some of the side plots get a little bit lost in not enough screen time. Like, there is a little bit of... But that's maybe also just my TV brain. I love watching TV, so I'm always like, I need more. Give me more side plots.
Maybe, but it's weird you say that, because I had the same thought. I thought the film seemed very short, and that there wasn't really a lot of development for any of the relationships, really. And although it's not an especially short movie. It's an hour 40 minutes, so... But I think, as you say, we're just used to either long-form TV miniseries or really long movies that are at least 2 hours long and stuff. So
1 or 2 minutes is, I'd say, short for nowadays. Yeah, as a movie.
Oh, an hour 40 is short for nowadays. Definitely, you wouldn't expect it to be that short now. But yeah, odd.
Yeah, I think a lot of some of them are a little undercooked. Like, I still got what they were trying to say with them, but.
Okay.
I think it was more of a thing. Sorry, it needed time to understand, because it didn't show me so much, so I needed to reflect on it later to go, oh, this is what they were trying to do with this couple, because it was too little in the moment to get it in the moment, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do, and I think there's moments that, like I said, for me, just there's a lot of things that I don't particularly love the kind of that happen in the movie. I'm not overly fond of the idea that the Vincent character has an affair, the Vincent Gardenia character, and his wife knows about it, and it's immediately kind of, as you said, because it is such a short movie, and perhaps because it's trying to be tongue-in-cheek, it's literally a question of being, oh, I want you to stop seeing her. Okay. I'm like, oh, that's kind of, that's the really quick and undramatic way of handling that, and I'm not sure I love it, and there's no real consequences or anything.
I feel like this could have worked, this short answer, if we had more time with them to understand the characters better. So we could.
Yes.
Because I feel like you could argue it makes sense for that dynamic that this happened this way, but we didn't really spend so much time with them that I feel like I got it from them. I just, from the performance and from the writing, it's more like I have to believe that this is the case for the dynamic, because the movie is telling me that it is. So I'm just like, okay, I believe.
Absolutely,
you.
Yeah. And the same thing happens with Johnny. I mean, he kind of gets over being dumped by his fiance, who's then leaving with his brother, but he's chuffed because he's part of this family anyway. And I was like, I get the humor part, but it's kind of like, it just felt very, very kind of unrealistic for me and a bit like weird. But yeah, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. But yeah, referring back to what you were saying, kind of Sandy, about this kind of, it's an original movie, but it's also kind of, for me, it's got a kind of timeless quality. And I don't think it's an accident that La Boheme is featured, the opera, in the movie. It's, you know, the kind of tragic romance and the complications of all of that. And is that something that you picked up from the film, Sandy, as well? And do you think there is a link to be found there?
There must be, but I honestly tried to sit down and read the synopsis of La Boheme, and I couldn't, I didn't get that done in time. I didn't quite get all my homework done. So I wasn't really sure. I'm sure that there must be, but I wasn't, I'm not aware of it because I didn't read it, but I just do think it has a lot to do with the color of life and passion.
Yeah.
And that's what I really took from it.
Yeah, I can't say I've read it, but when I was doing my research, it basically said the, you know, the reflected themes are things like the nature of fate, and you can control it yourself even if you think you can't, and passion versus practicality being the main thing, which of course feeds heavily into Loretta marrying a man she doesn't really love just because she wants this, you know, stability, and she thinks she's cursed anyway after the first marriage, and the whole conversation she has with Ronnie about not waiting for the right guy to come along because she'd waited long enough, etc. And yeah, there's kind of a lot of that kind of stuff that feeds in, like I said, which I get. And what about you, Adrian? Did you pick up on any of this? And is there anything else that you thought that we kind of missed?
I agree with everything you said, especially about passion just taking over, and, you know, love and acceptance in the end of family.
Mm-hmm. That's fair enough. Fair enough. Cool. So, yeah. And I'm guessing, Toby, it's probably a cultural thing that may have been a little bit lost on you, without wanting to sound too offensive. I'm guessing you're not familiar with La Boheme.
I am not familiar with opera.
Yeah, I'm not, me neither. I'm not insulting you, because I wouldn't have a clue about opera either. And yeah, I don't think I'd be sitting there enraptured and in tears like Cher. I'd probably be asleep if I was at the opera. But look, you know,
yeah,
I get it.
Like, it's impressive, but like, for hours, I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, that's fair enough. So what was I going to say? So yeah, I mean, since I've brought it up, how do you ladies feel about the kind of secondary relationship in the movie? I guess, which would be, you know, it's Loretta's parents, and how, you know, the dad is having an affair and the mum is trying to come to terms with it. And then, like I said, this very weirdly quick resolution for me. Adrian, what do you think of that?
Well, he got caught. And what's he going to do? You know, is he going to argue and say, she's so much better and she's this, that, and the other? I mean, he comes to realize that he was stupid and that she, you know, she didn't leave him. She just moved on in her life, you know. I mean, I guess it comes down to she knows who she is, and he had his midlife crisis, and he came back to reality, and she chose to stay. So,
yeah, it leaves a bad taste in my mouth because it's kind of like he gets away with this wandering around and going out with another woman, and she kind of doesn't get to and gets to be the noble hero that doesn't kind of do anything with the John Mahoney character. And I'm kind of like, this sucks, really, in a way. Like, he's done everything right.
Yeah, but she knows who she is. Like she said, she has the upper hand. She doesn't need all that.
I get it. It's not very nice. In the writing, it's not very kind of, to my mind, it's not particularly kind to the women in that regard, you know. Although I get it that Loretta's the one that's quote-unquote cheating in her relationship. But, you know, there's enough scene, I would say, arguably, that, you know, that she's not really in a particularly loving and caring relationship anyway.
Right.
So you're not really, like, I'm not really rooting for Johnny. I'm kind of like, yeah, this guy's clearly an asshole and doesn't really appreciate her, you know, right from the start, from the opening kind of, do you want to marry me? Well, you wouldn't, you know, at least get on your knees or something. Yeah.
He's then, too wimpy. He doesn't have any fire in him, but yeah.
Exactly, yeah. But he also just... I just get the sense he doesn't really care for her. He's kind of like her. He's kind of going through the motions like, oh, well, I should be married, so I guess we'll do that, you know, kind of thing. What about you, Sandy? Would you say we are on the right area here? Or, and how do you feel about the kind of the affair?
Well, honestly, I don't love that he was having an affair. But I think that the writing was trying to portray all these different relationships. And it was necessary for the writing. But, I mean, you have, you know, Cosmo and Rose and Cosmo's affair. And then you have Raymond and Rita, you know, and their relationship and how loving it is, how close they are. Yeah. And they're not experiencing these problems. And then you have Frasier's dad in the diner with women who are too young for him. But particularly speaking on Cosmo's affair, you know, it was one thing when they pointed out that he was cheap. He doesn't want to pay for this, doesn't want to pay for that, but he's buying this woman gifts. But at the same time, it's, you know, like you said, he's not really in love with this woman. He's just going through these motions of having this affair. When he gives her the bracelet, he's like, oh, birds fly to the stars, I guess, you know? And it feeds into that, you know, question that Rose was asking to be answered the whole time, and him talking about he doesn't go to bed because, you know, it feels like he's dead or dying. It's him trying to chase his youth, and that's all it was. And she tells him at the movie, you know, hey, enough of that. And he's like, okay, you're right, enough of that. And it was just this moment in their, I don't know, probably what, 30, 40 year long marriage. It was this small moment in time, and it means nothing in the end.
I don't know if I would be as forgiving as the Rose character. As I say, I think I would I certainly wouldn't be like, I want you to stop, okay, cool, now everything's, you know, peachy again. I'd be like, nah, I'd at least be passionate and throwing some plates at his head or something if it was me. But again, I think it's maybe a product of the times and maybe a cultural thing. I don't know that it's kind of
he probably paid for it. I'm sure there was repercussions, as you say. She probably made him pay for it.
Yeah, my boy, my boy is definitely sleeping on the couch for a year.
Yeah.
I really hope so. And that's why I think I missed the plot of the idea that him and Loretta would be going to a homeless shelter, because they acknowledged, you know, that they've done wrong and they're kind of trying to find some kind of penance, as opposed to just like, oh, I got caught, oops, you know. Even though I don't think what Loretta did is remotely comparable, frankly, to be honest with you. So
I mean, no. She wasn't even they weren't even married.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, she slept with Ronnie once, and then immediately was like, it's a mistake. And then even at the opera, even though she got all dolled up and everything, as soon as he'd lent in for the kiss, she was like, no, you know, I said I'd go to the opera and that's it. So, yeah. So, you know, fair play to her. I don't think she was, and as I said, she was clearly in a loveless relationship anyway. So, you know, I'm a little bit more sympathetic, whereas, you know, the Cosmo clearly had love in his relationship. And, you know, there's the whole thing about the, you know, the night that he thought that he'd brought the moon over for her and how passionate they were. And for me, there isn't really enough of an exploration of where that passion went and why he's got a wandering eye about it and stuff. And I would have liked to have seen that. Like, well, you know, what was, you know, that was so deeply in love that suddenly now isn't. And and see more of their relationship, because you don't even see a lot of them together, really. And you see a lot of them separately doing their own things. But yeah, anyway, that's just my particular thoughts on the plotting anyway.
I think you're not supposed to see them together because, you know, he doesn't. I guess they just we talk about passion. They've lost the passion of their relationship. The Kapamachis are still so amazingly passionate, and Loretta's finding passion now. Like, which way is she gonna go? Is she gonna be like her parents in her marriage, or is she gonna be like the Kapamachis? And we're all rooting for the Kapamachi way.
Yeah, I guess, but like I said, there wasn't enough for me in kind of like, well, why is that? They're not dealing with where the passion has gone. I mean, you get the kind of arbitrary thing about, oh, he's wondering because he's terrified of death, and yeah, I understand that, and yeah, fair enough, I get it, but like I said, there wasn't really for me enough exploration of that relationship, which is pretty central to the movie, you know, but yeah, it's just, that's just me, and I think our modern sensibilities maybe when it comes to that, but I mean, it is the central tension of the movie, as I say, the idea of Loretta's safe engagement and the irresistible connection to Ronnie, and this idea, like I said, of passion versus practicality. Mm-hmm. So it kind of all feeds into that, I guess. Yeah. Although, like I said, it's not super clear for me what side of that Cosmo comes down on. Like, does he give up the passion for the practicality in the affair? Is it the other way around, or what's happening with that? So, Toby, what are you? You've been very quiet. What do you think about some of these things? Is this things that you've picked up on in the movie, or?
I mean, we already talked earlier about not enough time, so we don't need to repeat that. And about the homeless shelter scene, it was cut.
Yeah.
I get why this would help the movie more, because the part where she's regretful is only this little part in the church, which feels very throwaway, because she just goes in, said I sin, and then the father's basically, okay, pray, go.
Yeah.
So it's a little, like, that's a little fast. And and I do feel like this scene only really exists because after what she finds out that he's cheating, well, that is cheating. And I feel like they needed to have this little why is she in the church moment too.
I got you, yeah. Like, why she's not as bad as him, maybe, kind of thing. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
That and also just for location issues, because I think otherwise they needed to reshoot the scene for
location. Yeah.
So I'm just like, okay, I get why you included that.
But, I see, yeah.
I mean, I don't know how much the homeless shelter scene would have really added in the end, because I get why it would help, but I think we've seen enough, even in the opera, about how Loretta feels about this whole thing.
Yeah.
To maybe it would have helped for Ronnie to get a little bit. That I could see.
I think it would have helped with me with Cosmo more than anything with the dad character. So, and you know, maybe she could tag along and be like, yeah, I kind of did something that would be acknowledged as bad as well. So. But it's more, like I said, the idea that Cosmo got away is a horrible way of putting it, but got away with his affair with his wife knowing, and was kind of like, oh, well, all right, it's over, but it still happened, you know? And like I said, I think I'd have liked to have seen more consequences to that other than just him bang the table once and say, okay, and then it's over with. And I'm like, I get that, like I said, the tongue-in-cheek nature, but it's just kind of weird for me. I'd rather have had a bit more.
For me, it's less about seeing the consequence, but more about I don't understand why she is so forgiving.
Yes.
And I just gotta take the movie's word for it. And
she does call him out, though, in front of the whole family. He doesn't defend himself or try to make excuses or even deny it.
Yeah, he can't really. He's been caught. You know, it's like you said, so. There's kind of something that it would be pointless to try and defend himself. I mean, I get it a little bit more than you, Toby, because I get the sense that Rosa's character, the Olympia Dukakis character, is quite noble, and she wants her marriage to work. She kind of does love that passion and that love existed, and thinks that they can get it back, and just wants to understand what's going on. So I get why she would ultimately eventually forgive him, but I just think she came across as a little bit of a pushover by just it being so quick and hardly dealt with. But again, that's, you know, modern sensibilities, I guess. Anything else you guys wanted to bring up before I ask the next question?
I would just say that the culture does seem to embrace, at least as portrayed in the movie, seems to embrace that passion without reason.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's the kind of final question I'll ask about this. But I did want to say as well, when I'm kind of dealing with my notes here, I was initially kind of annoyed about the idea that Ronnie was kind of like a violent asshole that gets the girl, because I was like, oh, yeah, when he's like flinging the table around him, whatever. But I did appreciate that it's portrayed not like that. It's just passion, and that it goes to great lengths, the movie, to show that like their tryst is incredibly consensual. Like, you have Cher saying, oh, go ahead, lots of times in the movie, as opposed to just, which could have been really problematic if it was portrayed as him just like, I'm just taking you here and now. And so I really did appreciate that she knew exactly what she was doing. She went into it with her eyes open, consented fully and everything. And I was like, okay, I get it. It's just passion. And she acknowledges, oh, in the passion of the moment, but what the heck, just do it. And I don't care anymore, etc. And, you know, it was a passionate scene. To be fair, it worked quite well as a kind of a passionate love scene. Did you guys think the same way?
Well, and it's very funny because, Johnny in the restaurant laughs at Fraser's dad. I can't remember his name. But he says, you know, I just have to laugh. It's funny, a man who can't control his woman. When in this entire thing, Cher lets him believe that. Loretta lets him believe that. She controls what he eats. She controls what Ronnie eats. You know, she's like, no, you'll take it bloody. You know, and no, you won't have the fish. Take the dessert cart back. And to even to think, that's one of the things I was talking about. It happens more than once. But one of the things I was talking about where they're saying one thing, but in reality, another thing is true. And the women are very much in control, all of them in this movie. The woman who walks out on her professor, Loretta, Rose, all of them.
That's a really interesting perspective that I hadn't considered, but I think you are right as well. That is absolutely the point, is that it's maybe trying to say the women are the ones holding everything together and the ones that are ultimately the power here. And very much so in the case of Johnny, as you said, he comes across as really sexist and I'll control your woman. But like you said, he's not only is Loretta making all the decisions for him, he ultimately can't, you know, stand up to his mum. He's like, oh, we can't get married. Mum's still alive, you know.
She even takes his beloved pinky ring twice, not once, but twice.
Exactly, yeah. So the last question I want to ask about the writing, and then I'll just talk a little tiny bit about some of my notes, is do you guys think the movie is saying that passion is always better than stability, or do you think it's trying to say that balance is needed, not to, you know, be too leading? Sandy, I'll come to you.
Oh, good, because I have something to say.
Okay.
I think the film is trying to say, and that's its right. I think the film is trying to say passion kind of takes over everything. Nicolas Cage's, one of his quotes is basically saying that. And I feel like it is what brings together the entire message when he talks about towards the end how he loves Loretta. And not like they told you love is, but love ruins everything. It breaks your heart. It makes things a mess. And we're not here to be perfect. We're here to basically embrace this messy passion, you know, no matter what a mess it makes of our lives, which, you know, does have another side to it, right? There's wreckage left in a broken marriage, that sort of thing. But that's not the part we're focusing on here, because there is a lot of beautiful things that come out of passion.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, yeah, it shows you, I mean, a microcosm of that is, like you said, in La Boheme, it's not a spoiler for that to say that Cher didn't expect the character to die and cries. And she kind of says, even in the tragedy, there's obviously a kind of beauty there, even though it wasn't expected. And she absolutely loved it. And I think, again, that's kind of feeding into that theme a little bit, maybe. I'm struggling with some of the themes and understanding them, and I do have a couple of questions about that. But first, Adrienne, what do you think about the main question? Is it saying passion is better than stability, or to find balance?
I'm thinking that within balance, there's passion. It's not one extreme or the other. It's following your own path, following your own heart, and just accepting that you don't have to settle for whatever. You know, I mean, the way the movie starts out, like, she literally is working that day at her funeral home. You know, there isn't a lot of joy and happiness and that, but you're still helping families. So I feel like, you know, she still lives at home. I just keep coming back to how important family is, and you make it work.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I definitely picked up on that, not to get all fast and furious on it, but the theme of family was very, I mean, even to the point that, like, when Loretta says she's getting married, Rose is like, oh, well, so are we going to move out? Are you guys moving into the house? You know, and the idea that they would have their own place and not be with the family is kind of bizarre to them. And even like Rose's father-in-law living with them in the house. Very. I mean, I think it's a cultural thing as well, probably, with Italian-American families and stuff. I can't really say for sure because I don't know any. But I get the sense it probably is kind of a cultural thing as well, as being about the times and about, you know, the importance of family, I guess, is something that I picked up on as well, for sure. And I think that's also a lot of the reason I can kind of forgive, ultimately, the forgiveness of the affairs and stuff, because it's more about keeping a family together. And even, like you said, the comedic way that it's like, well, Johnny, you're part of the family, so, you know. And it's, So I kind of got that as well, for sure.
And I think Grandpa really kept the family together, you know. Bringing Johnny in, making Dad say he'd pay for the wedding, you know, keeping the dogs around the family all the time, you know, in his great comedic way.
That was the one thing I didn't get, but maybe you can answer that, is that kind of like he gets the wrong idea when he sees Rose with Perry, Frasier's dad, as Sandy calls him. But he doesn't ultimately see anything. You think he's going to. And then instead he says, no, don't be cheap and pay for the wedding. And
I was like, is that just all of them keep each other's secrets.
Right. Gotcha.
You know, because, I mean, when Cher and Cosmo meet at the opera, they agree to keep each other's secrets, but they don't approve.
Okay. Oh,
I mean, it's so,
and I think he understands that, you know, passion is the spice of life, even as he visits the love of his life's grave, you know, presumably, or because later you see him literally howling at the moon.
Yeah, I know. I got that. And that was a very big sort of metaphor moment. I mean, the moon is used as a symbol quite a lot about love and passion and obviously, I'm guessing you guys would have picked up on that as well.
Yeah.
Whenever I do see a big moon, I still say, Cosmo's moon, look.
So do I. I still say, I still stare out and I say, it's Cosmo's moon. Oh. Is full of quotable moments. Like just kinds of them. Yeah.
For sure. For sure. But I can't leave you out, Toby. So the big question, like I said, is it, do you think it's seeing passions better than romance, or a mix is needed? And do you pick up on any of the kind of metaphors, the moon as passion and things like that as well?
I think the movie ultimately portrays both pros and cons of both sides, but takes this, but has as an opinion that passion is better. I think that's what the movie is trying to say, but it also gives you enough of understanding and showing stability so that you can also come out of this movie thinking, no, stability is better. But I think the author voice, I feel like, is that passion is better for two reasons. One, because I think we spend way more time with passion than stability in this movie, just from a time perspective. And two, I think this is kind of the note this movie ends on, celebration of passion. So I think for these two reasons, the movie is advocating for passion, but it also has enough understanding for why people want to choose stability, and also has people choosing stability so that you can, come out of is thinking, oh yeah, I maybe relate more to the characters and stuff that's more stability focused, and I like that more. So you could come out of that thinking that, but I think the movie is ultimately passion better.
I like what you said, a celebration of passion.
I think it's definitely saying there's a place that passion is necessary. I don't think it's saying you can live without it. And but it's weird you said that you thought it ended on a note of passion, because I thought the opposite. I thought it ended on the note of the stability of family and everything altogether. And I may be reading too much into this. I'm sure I probably am. But like the very last picture that you see of them all together as a family, it seems to me like Nick Cage looks thoroughly miserable. And I'm just kind of like, is this trying to say that, like, now that Ronnie's got that stability instead of the passion and he's in the family, he's kind of not as contented? Or am I just not, you know, is it just a random coincidence that's what Nicolas Cage looks like on that picture, you know?
He looks miserable. He looks miserable at the table?
No, in the picture at the very end, like when the credits roll, there's a picture of the now extended family. And they all look happy and they're all posing quite well. And even Johnny's beaming in the background. And Ronnie in the front of the picture just looks thoroughly, like, miserable, just pissed off and sad.
I didn't notice that. Maybe he just doesn't like taking pictures.
Yeah, I mean, it could be nothing. It could just be that Nick Cage didn't smile when they took the picture on that day. But it was weird that that was the note the film ended on. And I was like, huh, he really just doesn't look happy, bless him. And is he now, is the point now that, oh, the wolf is trapped in this situation again? And,
no, you're reading too much into it. You're overthinking that.
Maybe.
Well, the end note I'm talking about is not the picture, but the end scene of the table.
Yeah, the table.
I mean, in terms of Loretta picking Ronnie over Johnny, so to speak,
yeah.
I get your point. It's saying your passion won out, but... Yeah, it's weird because I wouldn't necessarily say that there's no love between those two either. I think Ronnie and Loretta, clearly, that's why it shows you them at the opera and outside the kind of doorway and that whole awesome speech about, oh, I'm here, you're late, etc. I think there's love there as well. So for me, it's kind of trying to tell you that there should be a balance. Even by talking about the way that Cosmo felt passionately, you know, the whole Cosmo's Moon speech at the start, yeah. I think it is saying you need something in between, but you can't survive on either just a passionless romance or... you know, just passion without love. So for me, it's kind of trying to strike a middle ground and say you've got to find that balance, maybe. I mean, we've kind of got to touch on it. It's more of a performance thing, but I do love the Nicolas Cage speech when they first encounter him and, you know, oh, I've lost my heart, I lost my pride, etc. Because I wasn't really expecting it to be the level of comedy gold that it is. And that was when I first got the sense that the film isn't taking itself deadly seriously. Like the idea that, like I said, he makes that speech and the director chooses to go with all that performance, but then does show everybody's face afterwards just looking dumbfounded, which is such a like pause to laugh moment. And then the speech afterwards with the random woman, it's like, I love him so much, but I could never tell him, and you know, he's so tortured and whatever else. And I was like, this is hilarious. It's weirdly funny. And it's not the only thing. I mean, the idea of Johnny constantly forgetting the suitcases is an interesting bit of kind of physical humor, I guess. And there's little bits like that, like I said, that's like, oh, okay, I get it. It's not fully going for melodramatic entirely, although there are moments, like I said, there's an awful lot of things and times in the film where I'm like, nobody speaks like this. This comes across like a melodrama script that they're acting out a lot of the time. Is that fair to say for you as well, Toby? Or
Yeah. Just, yeah.
We'll move to the acting. So, as we say, Cher in this movie plays Loretta Castorini. Apparently, between takes, Cher motioned to Olympia Dukakis that the movie was going to be a dud. She originally thought she was giving a bad performance, but she went on to win Oscars and Golden Globes for Best Actress. Yeah, that's weird to hear. Did you guys think Cher was good? I really liked her. I thought she was great in the movie. What did you think, Sandy?
I thought she was great, too. It was weird to hear that. And I wonder if it's just because, I mean... in ways, this parallels some of her own decisions that she's made in her life. And she's always come off as being a very passionate artist and creator. And so I wonder if that's why, because this just was very much in tune with who she is, maybe. Because I am surprised to hear that, honestly. I thought she was great in it.
Yeah, I really was impressed by the acting and the way she delivers the lines and things, but also that for the start of the movie, she's kind of willing to appear a little bit dowdy and to kind of glam herself down, which isn't her kind of pop star public image kind of thing. Okay, she gets the cool makeover scene, of course, halfway through and comes out and you're like, oh, wow, you look stunning all of a sudden, and you do get that moment. But at the start, like I said, I was kind of like, huh, she's making herself look older and a little bit less kind of glam than you might expect for this this person. So, yeah. Adrienne, what about you? What did you think of Cher's performance?
I like that Cher was just able to really reach in these really small settings, you know, and close settings with all these actors having to just work so much on dialogue and, you know, the little facial movements and everything. I'm sure she was really challenged, you know, especially with big personalities and stuff. So, and her own big personality.
Yeah.
I thought she was amazing.
And I know that you've said when we reviewed Tombstone that your experience, your first experience of Sam Elliott was everybody falling in love with him from the film Mask, which I'm guessing is another Cher performance that you would also say was great.
Oh, yeah. What a movie. We were just talking last night how we need to all watch it again.
It's one of my mum's favorite ever movies, actually. So I've seen it a lot.
Oh,
is it?
Oh,
yeah, it is,
wow.
Actually. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I love that.
Because it's necessarily something I would have seen, but that's how I have seen that movie.
Right, of course, yeah.
Yeah, and I've seen it a lot, as I said. Uh-huh. Yeah, fantastic performances in that movie. And I think that was when I kind of realized, wow, Cher is a serious actor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, to a lesser extent, she's obviously in things like Witches of Eastwick as well, which aren't as taxing, but it goes to show, you know, she's capable of acting. She's in that, right? With
Yes, she is. And Silkwood, you know, her early acting was... just really not being glam. I love that part. But you can't have Cher in a love story and not give her a glow up.
Absolutely. And she looks amazing. Yeah, for me, it's fully believable in this role. Mm-hmm. And I never question, oh, it's this pop persona or it's somebody else. I believed her as this character that's been through all these things. And I mean, that's ultimately the point, is that it made a hokey script for me, a little bit hokey, believable, and I could run with it. Whereas whenever I heard Nicolas Cage, I was like, this is just Nick Cage overacting a hokey script, you know? And for me, it's more, even more impressive that Cher, like you said, was acting opposite that and didn't rise to it and didn't try to meet it. She was just, you know, she...
Yeah.
So I can understand why she won the Oscar, and I don't begrudge that at all, by the way.
Oh, no, she really did well. I guess she wanted Nicolas Cage to be in the movie. You know, I guess she for him to play that part, even though he was only in his early 20s.
You know?
So interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen him make better performance choices. But again, I know some people would defend this. And like I said, at least it's, you know, whatever it is, it's doing something. But we'll get to Nick Cage in time. So first of all, though, what do you make of Cher's performance, Toby?
Cher is great in this movie. As you said, she's selling this movie in a movie of a lot of weird acting choices.
Yeah.
And acting choices is Nicolas Cage.
Yeah. I mean, lots of personalities, but there are
other acting choices as well that are a little, not as extreme as Nicolas Cage, but...
Yeah. No, I think, like I said, it's
amazing.
It's the fact that I know she has a big personality herself, and it comes off in the kind of, you know, the stage performer and the pop star and whatever, but her big personality doesn't overtake the script and the character. You know, she is able to temper that down quite nicely for me. And like I said, I followed that character's journey the entire way, and I never judged her, and I never felt like, oh, when she had her affair, she was terrible. I fully understood where she was coming from, and yet I understood the need for safety and staying with Johnny in the first place and all the frustrations towards him. So, yeah, I can't really say much else. I just think it was a great performance, and I can see why. Like I said, it was ultimately an Oscar-winning one. Yeah, moving on to...
And I feel like a lot of the characters come across as very character, like a character.
Caricature, yeah. Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Comic book.
And Cher's character, Loretta, is the only one I came out thinking she is a fully realized character. I know this person. I know what she's like. I know her, understand her, and she's selling that very well. Mm. Difference to some other acting. Well, for some characters, it's also the writing that just doesn't give them a lot, to be fair.
Yeah. No, I would counter that. I think the other Oscar winner, Olympia Dukakis, is the only other character that I'm like, I really appreciate this, and she seemed real, and there wasn't any, like, she was elevating the script by a good performance. But again, I'll get to that in time. First of all, I have to say, Nicolas Cage, as we said in the movie, plays Ronnie Camerari. The studio heads had Peter Gallagher in mind for the role of Ronnie, but Cher adamantly wanted Nicolas Cage to play Ronnie, as Adrian said. She thought he could play crazy more realistically. She shot a screen test with Gallagher and also one with Cage. After the tests, the studio still wanted Gallagher in the role, but Cher fought for Cage, insisting that she wouldn't do the movie without him. The studio relented, and Cage was cast. Gallagher would eventually be cast in a similarly themed film, While You Were Sleeping, 1995, which can't say I've seen, so I can't really comment. According to Nicolas Cage, the acting style he was channeling while doing the famous hand speech was inspired by watching the body language of actor Rudolf Kleinroge in director Fritz Lang's 1927 German expressionist film Metropolis, to which I would point out he's in a silent movie, Nick. He kind of has to be playing at large. You know, maybe chill out a little.
Homework.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's fair. It is, he's doing something. It's not that he doesn't care. I'll give him that much. And if nothing else, it's entertaining. But I just couldn't. I was, in terms of performance to watch for comedy, I was loving laughing at it. But my word, I can't call it a good performance. I'm so sorry. What would you make of it, Sandy?
Oh, I also thought it was hilarious. And especially how he played off of Chrissy. And how she's like, I won't do it, I tell ya. He's like, she won't do it. Yeah, I don't know. It's just really very funny.
Oh, was that in the opening scene where he's like, fetch the big knife?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just, it's funny how it all does, though, work as ridiculous as he is and as reserved as she is in her acting, but how when they're in scenes together, it all works very well together. And even though he acts ridiculous at times, I still took his character seriously. I know that he meant it, that he fell in love with her, that he did unrealistically blame his brother for him looking away from the slicer and losing his hand. And he's ridiculous, yes, but I definitely believed him. In this movie, and that he was in love with her, that he wasn't going to, you know, give up.
Okay, fair. I was just drawn out by the performance too much. Like I said, I think it emphasized the unreality and the unrealistic nature of the script, and it kind of just felt like he was reading a script, I guess. But yeah, again, personal choice. What about you, Adrian?
I'm trying to think how I felt about it the very first time, though, and I may have been more, you know, in agreement with you the first time I saw it, and it's really just maybe perhaps grown on me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. In time, you would eventually settle into it, I guess, anyway. But yeah, Adrian, what did you make of Nick Cage?
Well, I understand where he fits into the character world. You know, you have all these other men, and they're older, and they're kind of in their lives, even his brother Johnny, and he's just this wild card, got to come in. But it turns out he's the one who loves opera. You know, he's the one with the passion. He's the one who's funny in his own ways and just downright being himself and, you know, such a hard worker and everything. I liked it. Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah.
What about you, Toby? What did you make of this performance?
I mean, I love to make fun of it, but seriously, I think there are moments where it actually works. It's not completely garbage. I think in the opera there are moments where it works, and also after that, where they're in front of the apartment, I think that's also a scene where his acting works because it's still somewhat over the top, ridiculous, but it's toned down just enough so that it feels more like, oh, this is a quirk of the character and not just someone doing something weird for laughs. And there are moments where it's just so over the top that breaks the barrier of believability. It's like the scene where we first met him and and then sliced my hand and over the top, and that's a little much.
Yeah,
and I feel like maybe these moments could have worked more if this wasn't the first impression of him. I feel like that's also a part that could potentially play into it a little bit. But I think there are definitely moments where it works and his performance is good, and there are moments where it's like too much.
Okay. It's weird you say again that, because it was the moment outside of the house that put me off, because like I said, it was whenever he was saying something, I was like, people don't talk like this. It's blatantly a script, and he's following the script exactly and overplaying it to the point that I'm just like, it's coming across like fake melodrama and I don't believe it. Whereas I believe everything Cher says, no matter if it is a bit cheesy or a bit hokey, I still believe she feels that way. And him, I was just like, I'm just watching an actor. You know? Anyway, Yeah, moving on to the next one. Olympia Dukakis plays Rose Castorini. According to casting director Howard Feuer, both Anne Bancroft and Maureen Stapleton had been considered for the role of Cher's mother, but their fees were too expensive for the production budget. Feuer remembered Olympia Dukakis, a character actress known for years to most in casting. She read for director Norman Jewison, and he hired her instantly. The despondent moan that Olympia Dukakis repeats to herself throughout the film is a direct homage to the same moans that Dustin Hoffman delivers throughout The Graduate. I don't know, that's kind of cool. And yeah, I have to say, I think she's another fantastic character. And again, I can absolutely see why she would win a supporting actress Oscar, because she's very much, again, one of the more real people and one of the ones that's asking the deeper questions and reflecting some of the deeper themes of the film without it coming across as hokey. And, you know, oh, why are we doing this? What does love mean? Why do men cheat? Why do women, you know, why do women sometimes stay in passionless relationships? Why do they want to get married? And yeah, and as you said, she also gets the chance to be noble in kind of the relationship, even though I was the entire time I was like, oh, you should get with this guy, he's better for you, you know, because I also think John Mahoney was a fantastic performance, because even though he's being, you know, the stereotypical wandering eye dating younger women guy, when he actually gets the sort of chance to sit down and talk with Rose, he's quite charming, and I kind of believed his sort of loneliness in it, and I was like, huh, it's weird that I liked him more than I liked Cosmo, weirdly enough. But anyway, yeah, moving it.
I never thought of that. Never, ever, ever thought that they should get together or anything like that.
I'm surprised.
I don't think that was supposed to be.
I'm not saying that's what the film was saying, but I just liked that character more. But also, that might be 11 years of being charmed by the actor on a TV sitcom. You know what I mean? So. Yeah. And like I said, but I did like you said, that Rose, as much as I wouldn't have minded that happening, I did like that, like you said, she gets the chance to say, oh, I know who I am, and it's not going to happen. So
right. Thank goodness.
Not that she's saying, you know, I'm not attracted to you or I wouldn't like this. It's just like, I know who I am.
Right.
So, yeah, I love that, the way of putting it as well. So anyway, talking about both of them, Sandy, did you have anything to see on Olympia or on John?
Olympia, yeah, she was just really wonderful. Her whole journey through this movie of realizing her husband, you know, is, or believing her husband stepping out on her, right? She didn't even really know. She says, I think he's cheating on me. And she immediately has to know why. And she doesn't ever ask him, you know, but she just goes through all these different people and is trying to understand it, as opposed to just reacting to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, she doesn't ask him, but she does kind of hit him with the kind of what she thinks is, you know, the cause of it when she asks Johnny and he comes to the, and then, you know, Cosmo comes in and she's like, Cosmo, I just want you to know, no matter what you do, you're still gonna die.
Yeah.
Oh,
such a good line.
Just like everybody else.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And I was like, okay, cool. I get what
you're saying. Thank you, Rose.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a nice moment, though, because it is her taking her strength back as, like, yo, no matter what you try and do, it's stupid, and I'm still here for you, kind of thing. So I like
that. And what's funny, like Johnny, the most, the butt of the joke in the whole movie, comes up with the most poignant answer, in my opinion.
I think Olympia Dukakis is great as Rose, because I think she is the difference for me, because I had some trouble with Rose's characters, as we heard earlier. And I think she's the difference between, I don't get it, but I believe it, and I don't get it, and I don't believe it. I believe her, I just don't get it, because the movie is not giving me anything to get. But I believe her, because her performance is so great. Joe Mahoney, I think it's a solid performance. I'm not as like crazy about it as y'all are, but I don't think it's anything wrong with it. It's a performance in a smaller part. That's all there is to it.
Okay, cool. I'll move to the directing then, like I said, because I want to try and get ahead of time as best as we can. Director Norman Jewison was fined by the Actors Union for not allowing his actors to go to lunch until they perfected the moods of their characters for the climactic scene in the kitchen. Norman Jewison has stated that the climactic kitchen sequence was the most difficult scene he ever shot in his career. The crew were dismissed and Jewison rehearsed with the cast for some time using a stage production approach. Only after the actors perfected their timing did he decide where to put the camera. Jewison considers this movie his favorite of all the films he has directed. which does shock me a little, and I will say as a slight tease that next year on Cinema Classics, we will be looking at Norman Jewison's most famous movie. But that's all I will say about that. if you know, you know. So, yeah, other than that, I just have a couple of small things about the directing that I noticed. I liked the night-to-day transitions. I liked the framing, the focus on kind of the priest's hands and Loretta's face at the confession. I liked, as I said, the kind of the way that the deli couple, as I called them, come in and come and go from the movie. There's another comedy moment of, like, bumping into nuns, which I think is, it's when Loretta kind of, she's kind of said she's cursed, and then she goes for the makeover, and then she almost bumps into the nuns, and I was like, is this saying, like, oh, you may be cursed, you may be damned for this, or whatever? But I laughed either way. And yeah, the framing of her and Ronnie looking for each other, and the close-ups of, like, the face as they're watching, and the tears as they're watching the opera, I all loved all of that. So yeah, Sandy, you were going to say something. Sorry, I interrupted you there.
Oh, no, just agreeing, yeah, that part should have given her pause, but she... went ahead with her bags anyway, knowing she was setting herself up. Like, she's telling herself, and she's telling Johnny, this isn't going any further. But she's putting all this effort into how she looks. And this is coming from the inside out. He's kind of like awoken something in her. Yeah. And even though I think even in that moment, she knows internally, I'm saying this, but if he presses it, I'm probably going to give in. You know, I think, you know, she's coming to that reality.
I didn't really want to assume that, oh, all women have to dress for a man. So I kind of was like, well, you could just assume she likes to look pretty and has an excuse that she's, you know, maybe Johnny never takes her places like the opera and she's just enjoying the chance to be out looking pretty for herself, you know. But also, you know, like you said, there is definitely a trace of, like, or is she, you know, underneath it all, not admitting it, but really wanting to kind of acknowledge the kind of attraction with Ronnie and whatever. But yeah, maybe I've said too much about that. But Adrian, what did you make of all of the directing in general and the stuff we've talked about?
Well, I'm just imagining directing this cast, you know, of all these incredible actors. And especially, I think, that last scene. I mean, I could watch, I'm not the last scene, not the end credits, but the kitchen stuff.
The kitchen
scene, I could watch those 20 minutes or so, or maybe 15 minutes, just over and over, and focus on each actor and what they were told, how to, you know, the character is about and everything. And I thought the direction was great.
Awesome. Yeah. No, I can see why that was a scene that took a lot of time in staging. So what about you, Toby? Anything that stood out in the direction and the things that Sandy brought up as well?
I mean, not really about the direction, but I just thought of something because we were talking about the makeover scene. And while watching, I thought, she's getting all styled up for this date. And, like, no one asked her, like, hey, your fiance is not here. Who are you getting styled up for?
Well, they probably wouldn't know. I mean, they're not going to know all the comings and goings of every character and their, you know, loved ones or whatever. So, yeah. I mean, plus, I think, like I said, the women in the beauty salon were kind of implying, yo, you're an attractive woman and you've never really took care of yourself, and we've been waiting for a long time for you to just be like, do something, get rid of the gray and whatever. So.
Yeah, no one's like, why is she doing that now?
Yeah. Well, she may have just decided to make herself look pretty.
it's not like a huge problem in the movie. I just thought it was like,
yeah. I get it, but like I said, yeah.
No one asked him. No one was like, that's a little strange. That's a little odd.
Oh, I was fine with it. I mean, it's such a cool moment anyway. And I mean, I know it's cliche. I mean, it's cool. A great moment and she looks amazing. She looks great. So I was fine with it, to be honest.
And I mean, yeah, I'm fine with it. I just thought it was funny in the moment.
Yeah. So, oh, I get you. Yeah. I mean, yeah, obviously. But then again, you could also potentially think that, you know, maybe everybody doesn't like Johnny and knows they don't work together. So they're secretly kind of not bothered. But anyway. So yeah, that moves us on to the VFX production design, because I did already say I love the makeover. I love the hair, makeup, the dress that they put her in. I think it's amazing. I think the authentic New York City setting, I think, really works. The fact that it's not backlots and things, it's actual New York stoops and kitchens and the actual opera. And yeah, I love the moon shots. I mean, it's an easy gimme, you know, to look romantic when you're filming New York City at night with a full moon, but it works and it looks really good. And yeah.
La Bella Luna.
Exactly, the pretty moon. So, yeah, I mean, is there anything that you guys wanted to bring up about the VFX production design, and particular with view to this question, do you think the film feels dated visually, or do you think the more grounded style makes it a bit more timeless? And again, Sandy, I'll come to you first.
I'll go with the second. I think it does make it a bit more timeless, although it's capturing a moment in time that I'm not sure will, you know, I'm not sure it will be timeless forever, but at this point I can say it.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I think for me, it is very much an 80s thing, and I can see, because I've lived through that, that I recognize a lot of the, you know, random little things, certain ways the houses are decorated and stuff. But I also think it's not the outdoor scenes and the kind of New York City at night and stuff. I think that's going to stay timeless pretty much forever. You know?
I mean, I think it's timeless in this in the sense that I feel like it's doing this sort of style so well that that I feel like this movie could look like this coming out nowadays, obviously higher quality, like not in 480p or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Of course. But it could come out today looking like this as just an inspiration of, oh, we try to imitate, try to capture that style, that essence. I think it's doing that so well that it doesn't really come across as, oh, this is so 80s.
Yeah, no, it doesn't.
It has that effect of it. It has that effect of it being 80s, but not over the top 80s. If you know what I mean, like it's
yeah. I think a little bit of my own kind of like I can recognize this as the 80s is just nostalgia for that period. Like I said, so when you see like the way things were interior decorated and the way family homes were and everything, even though I'm not from New York, I was kind of like, oh, I can remember these things.
Right. Those good cars.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh,
exactly.
Those big cars are so great. But it's also a very specific kind of nostalgia too, where, you know, big Italian warm Italian families without invoking the mafia. You know, there's nothing to do with that.
And I think it also doesn't hurt that growing up with 80s movies, there's also a kind of nostalgia for other films set then as well that that I didn't live through, but, you know, that it kind of invokes them anyway. So, yeah, moving on to the music and sound, as I desperately try and race through. The opening title sequence was originally played on the score from Labo M Opera, but it was changed to the Dean Martin track That's Amore because the preview drew negative test audience reaction. Many people shifted uncomfortably in their seats thinking they'd been lured into an art film. Yeah, I kind of, when that happened, I was like, this seems a little jarring, this That's Amore to these very overly romantic imagery and stuff. And I was like, oh, I get what happened. I see now. But yeah, other than that, I love the score. I love that the score has this kind of whimsy. It's got a fairy tale feel. It's got an Italian sound to it. It's got romance. There's a little bit of sort of humor in it at times as well. Mm-hmm, and yeah, so you obviously agree with me on that, Adrian.
Yes, the every little sound, every little step, every little sound, every scene has its own little tiny musical vignette. Especially, I keep coming back to the old man and the dogs. Like,
yeah, but it's a good scene. Yeah.
Yes. Well, all the scenes with him have little chirpy, happy music, you know, with the dogs. Yes. And I loved that. I thought that was great.
But that is a romantic moment in its own way. It doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to be romance between people. It's a romantic kind of, oh, I'm howling at the moon of passion.
Oh,
kind
sure,
of thing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Awesome. And what about you, Sandy?
And I think he loves those dogs too. It's a different
thing. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And
they're also family. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, funny thing about that actor is, I think Sean Connery said to the director about that actor, well, he can't hear and he can't see, but he will steal every scene he's in because he was in The Name of the Rose with Sean Connery.
Oh, okay.
So like they knew each other. And cool. I thought he was such a great casting. But anyway. Thank you.
That's very nice. I always like to hear stuff like that. And what about you, Sandy? What did you make of the music anyway?
I really like the music, and of course the opening and closing song. Now it honestly always reminds me of this movie.
Yep.
Instead of the other way around.
Yeah. I can see that. Yeah. Good song though. Good song. That's Amore. Anyway, what about you, Toby? Any thoughts on the music specifically? Or
I mean, that opening song is a choice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's so kitschy. I'm sorry. I was starting where I was going like, oh, God, what is this movie going to be?
But what, how would you have felt if it had opened with an opera scene?
Yeah. I feel like it would have been a little odd, but I feel like it would have at least piqued my interest. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
I feel like opera isn't... I mean, it can be kitschy opera, but I don't think it has to be. And I think the soundtrack isn't... It really doesn't feel kitschy to me, the opera soundtrack.
No. No, I think it is just a case of, like you said, I can imagine... I can see why people would just be like, oh, is this an art house movie rather than a mainstream kind of rom-com?
I mean,
yeah.
Find a different song.
Yeah.
I feel like this must have been top five worst songs to choose.
Well, when the moon hits your eye. So the moon part kind of brings it together.
If you mention love songs and Italian, it's the immediate go-to that everybody would, like, it's the first thing I would think of and I'd put it on. Yeah. Like, oh, that's Amore. Of course.
Right. Well, I also would think that it would have been popular during their years when they were falling in love, you know, Cosmo and the Heads generation, you know, it would have been a popular song for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Plus, again, it's the 1980s. I mean, every sitcom, every TV show had a really cheesy opening in a similar way. You know?
True, yeah.
So, but yeah, anyway. I'll move us on then to the next bit, which will be the audience response section. I always put out a prompt on social media asking what you think of the movie. Disappointingly, I have to say, not a single response on social media for this movie. Nobody had any thoughts, whether they haven't seen it. I don't know, or I couldn't say. So I have had to resort to going to Letterboxd and some of my Letterboxd friends for their thoughts on the film. So bear with me. There's not a lot, like I said. And again, if you do see our audience prompts, please respond. It gives us a chance to get some other people's views on the movie into the episodes. So we'll start with my friend Alex Marzonia, who gives the film 4 stars and says, fun family stuff, a little tidy at the end, but was expecting so much more from its Oscar-winning reputation. Endearing with broad examinations and conversations about love. Of course, I eat that up like a pizza pie. Mike Lord also gives 4 stars and says, delightful romantic comedy from Norman Jewison. True_gritty gives 4.5 stars and says, oh, you sweet little gem of a movie. As we like to say around here, how could I have waited so long to finally watch you? Cher and Nicolas Cage work so well off each other. They could have teamed up and done a few more like this and no complaints here. But it does beg the question, is this movie even more Italian than The Godfather? I mean, when you play That's Amore that many times in one movie, I just have to ask. Yeah, we did say. Mr_Zeeb gives another 4 stars and says, a completely off-kilter movie. This film is odd but super fun. Cher feels like the only real person and everyone else is a caricature of themselves, as Toby was saying. This could make it bad, but it makes the film better. I could have used more interaction between Cher and Nicolas Cage to be convinced they love each other, but the family dynamic is fun to watch. By the way, Nicolas Cage's hand is one of the funniest plot points I've seen in a while. Yeah. Someone just called Robert gives it a full 5 stars and says, the first time I see a film, different feelings flow through me. Some make me happy, some make me sad, some excite me, some dazzle me. This is why I love watching movies. I never know what I'm in store for. I don't know how many movies made me feel like Moonstruck, but I do know it's a short list. I fell in love instantaneously and I can't wait to find the next movie that makes me feel this way. And finally, Michael Stark simply gives it 4 stars and has the one word, delightful. And I did, as I said earlier, if I did leave it in, send DK the video of just the opening Nick Cage scene and the performance there. And as I said, he responded with simply 4 words of feedback. I have no words. So that's, I can't really say much fairer than that. So anyway, that's what the audience thought. Now we just have to finish up with some of our thoughts. And again, on my episodes of Silver Screen Regular and Classic, I always like to give favorite character moment and line in the movie. So we'll deal with them all together, but individually. And Adrian, I'll come to you first. Do you have a favorite character moment and line, starting with character?
I give it to Olympia Dukakis. I thought about Cher, of course, but I think I just love, your life is going down the toilet.
you have to stop acting out these movies when you're doing the reviews, or I'm just going to want you to do it every time. You did the same with Tombstone. Your fantastic Southern Cowboy drawl was just, I wanted to hear you act it all out. I want you to be in the casting rooms with Sam Elliott going for the same roles.
Yay, me and Sam Elliott ride off on a motorcycle at the end.
So yeah, what was your favorite moment or scene in the movie?
I love when I think the humor part of when everybody's coming to the table and everybody thinks it's always Johnny, but it's somebody else. And then in the end, it turned out it's Johnny who says he can't marry Loretta and she's all mad. You know, I just thought that that whole scene was great.
And did you have a favorite line that you can think of for the film?
I still think my favorite line is the line I said at the beginning, someone tell a joke. Because <Yeah. laughs> it's so awkward for a minute. And he's like, what's going on here? I thought that was good.
Fair enough. Awesome. And Sandy, what about you then, starting with favorite character?
I love Ronnie.
Okay.
I like his, you know, just his passion and how he was, you know, like Loretta, just working in the dungeon, pretty much just going through each day, throwing the bread in the oven, and how, you know, his passion was awakened also, just like our main character. But I just really liked him. I thought his comic relief was good. And my favorite line is the much maligned, I lost my hand. I lost my bride. And just like the shaking of the arm with each syllable of the sentence. Johnny has his hand. Johnny has his bride. And I just love that part. Not for any deeper meaning other than it's just the part that brings me the most joy in the movie. I think it's so funny.
That's fair enough. Was that your favorite scene or moment as well then?
Yes. Yes.
Fair enough. Awesome. Toby, what about you, starting with favorite character then?
First of all, I want to say I am rooting for this woman at the airport cursing planes. I wish her nothing but the best.
At least we hope her sister tripped and fell when she came
off. Yeah, maybe don't kill the entire plane load of people.
No, yeah. Not the plane, only her.
Yeah,
she should lose her luggage forever.
Step on Lego brick. Best character, I gotta give it to Cher, Loretta.
Mm. Yeah,
I think. Okay. The best acted performance, I think the best written character, the most interesting character, the character I was following the most, most interested in most, I think I got to give it to her. Okay. Favorite scene is next, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Favorite scene, the moment Loretta shares with Ronnie outside the apartment after the opera, that's my favorite scene. And okay. My favorite line, snap out of it!
Nice. Well, you stole my favorite line, Toby, because that was mine as well. I'll say it now. I'd read somewhere that it was an iconic moment after watching the movie, but it was the moment that really kind of it caused me to kind of react weirdly and kind of get shocked but also laugh, when he's like, I'm in love with you, and the last thing you expect is for him to get a big slap and her go snap out of it. I was like, okay, awesome. So yeah, that's my favorite line. I may as well work backwards. My favorite scene, honorable mention to the breakfast table confrontation at the end and to Cher's transformation scene before the opera. But my favorite scene has to actually be Cage's first speech, just because it is comedy gold, like I said. So I'm kind of with you on that one to that degree, Sandy, in that regard. And favorite character, I was also torn between Rose and Loretta, the two Oscar winners. But I think I found Cher slash Loretta just a bit more compelling. So I would have went with Loretta, I think, for that one. So... yeah, so then all that remains for us to do is give our conclusion on a score out of 5 stars. You probably know the drill by now. Certainly our guests here do. Again, I'm looking at mine and realizing it's 3 paragraphs long. I always write far too long of a conclusion, so I will go last. But Adrienne, do you want to go first and give your conclusion and score?
Yes, I give this movie a 4.5. It's been a comfort movie to me since it came out. I love the characters. I love the music. I love the food. It's just a great, happy place for me to be.
Okay, awesome. Sandy, what about you next then?
I also gave it a 4.5. Wow. And just for me, I love the... I also, like Adrienne, the comfort of the movie, being around the family, all the different generations, all the different types of love and love stories in it. And that in the end, it gives us permission. Nicolas Cage is towards the end saying, you know, the stars are perfect, but we're not. We're here to ruin ourselves and break our hearts and love the wrong people. And it's kind of like if you're following your passion, you really can't make any mistakes in life, understanding that in reality that has boundaries. But as far as what the art is telling me and what Nicolas Cage's performance is telling me is that, you know, it's okay. And so I just really love that as someone who does live a very quiet, very normal, very passionless life. I find it here. And it just fills me with love and happiness for them. I'm so happy that in the end, it worked out for Loretta and Ronnie.
Okay, cool. That's quite deep thoughts. Okay, what about you, Toby? Did you have a conclusion and score out of 5?
I mean, I don't want to have to lower score. Please don't let me have to lower score. It's not
you
that.
You probably won't, to be fair, because I haven't gone yet.
Never mind. I changed mine to 4.9. I got to balance out, Toby. No,
go on, Toby. Be honest.
I think it's a good movie. I think there's good themes. It's a little undercooked, I feel like, especially when it comes to the side characters and their storylines. There could have been a little bit more at times. The acting is mostly good. Some weirder choices. Looking at you, Nicolas Cage. I will keep dragging this. And I gave it a 3.5 out of 5, which is
okay.
A good score. It means good. It means good.
Yeah, that's good. That's a very good score. That's very reasonable. So, let me just pull up my conclusion here. And again, sorry, I know it's very long. Right. So I said, my first thought after finishing this was how short it felt. At just over an hour and 40 minutes, it isn't unusually brief, but I could happily have spent more time with these characters. On the flip side, a lot of what does happen feels rushed, underdeveloped, or slight. As a piece of filmmaking, it's artfully directed, visually striking, and layered with themes worth exploring. As a slice of real life, it's about as believable as a WWE storyline. The dialogue is painfully artificial. Nobody talks like this. That said, heightened dialogue can work if the performances are grounded, and Cher, Olympia Dukakis, and John Mahoney absolutely deliver, deserving real credit for anchoring the film. And then there's Nicolas Cage, not so much chewing scenery as devouring it wholesale. More ham than a series of butchers with all the subtlety of a cartoon sledgehammer. It's a terrible performance, but one that's so hilariously entertaining you can't look away. Still, it tips an already hokey script into full-blown melodrama. On top of that, the gender and romantic politics are woeful at times, and those really grated on me. Yet despite all that, I didn't dislike the film. The direction, those strong central performances, a cheeky sense of comedy, charming supporting characters, and an undeniable sweetness all pulled me back in. I could be cynical about the schmaltz, but it mostly worked on me. I doubt I'll revisit this often, outside of chuckling at Cage's unhinged intensity, but it was enjoyable enough with plenty to admire. Not quite amore, but mi piace. I liked it. And I gave it 3 out of 5. So you were not the lowest score. And I have to say, you made a better pick with Tombstone Adrian than this one, I've got to say. But but not bad by any means. I mean, still a positive, still on the plus side. So gathering all of those scores, dividing by the 4 of us here, gives a final score for Moonstruck of 3.875 out of 5.
I think that's
not bad. Yeah, I mean, nearly 4. Very good, yeah. And you're all happy with that?
Well, it lines up with Letterboxd's 3.8 out of 5.
Is that what it has on average? Wow, that's weird. That is so bizarre. Ooh, we hit the average bang on. Anyway, cool. What about you, Adrienne? You happy with that or upset with it?
Oh, I'm not happy with it, but...
It's your podcast, my dear. We are just riding along.
Well, your 4.5s are on record. But yeah, I think maybe nostalgia on your part, perhaps is clouding the judgment a touch. Anyway, and so as the sound of Dean Martin's That's Amore drifts away and we all leave the family kitchen, it just remains for me to thank our wonderful guests. Adrienne, first of all, did you have fun and where can people find you online?
I always have fun here and I'm not on social media until things change in this country. So there.
Oh, well, we may be waiting a while for that one then.
Yeah, we might be.
All right. I hope not, but you know, I suppose, live in hope. Anyway, Sandy, the same question to you. Did you have a nice time? And is there anywhere people can find you? Anything you want to plug?
I did have a fun time. I'm happy that y'all were exposed to this movie, for better or for worse. And I'm also not on social media because there's too much good TV and movies to watch.
Fair enough. And well, we can always find all of you guys on our Discord, which is where we usually do, and we are the Discord crew. So, and speaking of which, Toby, thanks for joining us again. And are you up to anything online these days?
I mean, I'm still on Blue Sky, Dark Sonic, and please follow me. Nobody likes my style. Nobody talks to me on this platform.
I never see myself. Stuff.
Which is I good.
I mean, it's mostly stuff that you don't even care about, so it's not.
We don't want you busy over there. We want you busy on Discord with us.
I'm busy on the Discord.
I know. That's why we don't want anybody to follow you on Blue Sky.
Awesome. And yeah, if anybody has any thoughts on Madonna, Toby's currently working his way through her discography.
So. That I didn't post on Blue Sky.
No, that's a Discord thing. Absolutely. Discord thing. So yeah, and we're not going to talk about her acting career.
It's best to leave that.
And most of all, thanks to you out there for sticking with us and enjoying the episode. Hopefully you did. And if so, please do all the usual things. Like, comment, subscribe, and share the love. You'll find all our links for socials in the episode description with our link tree or on screen during the episode outro. And we'll be back very soon with a change of pace. The moon will shine on something far more macabre than romance as we enter spooky season with a special crossover of all three Silver Screen shows, taking on a very fitting trilogy. Let's just say they're coming to get you, Barbara. So yeah, until then, remember, no matter who you are, your life is not built on nothing. Ciao for now.
You have been listening to the Silver Screen Podcast, hosted by Mike Wilson. Follow us on social media, our YouTube channel, or wherever you get your podcasts. Link to all of these places can be found via the link tree listed in this episode's description. This podcast is a Media Matters original production, created, produced, and edited by Mike Wilson. We'd love it if you'd like, subscribe, and share us around like a beloved old video cassette. We hope to see you next time for more movie magic. Until then, remember, life moves pretty fast, so stop and watch a movie now and then.